Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hello, this is the Falls Church Police. The party is over. If you just grab your stuff and leave, there won't be any hassle.
Hey, fuck you, man.
All right, so it's an exciting time here in the basement.
It really
is, right?
Jim.
We are doing what some might call fan service. The fans have been asking for this series of episodes, and so we're now going to do it. We're not gonna do like the band we're talking about and not do what the fans might want. We're actually going to do this, right? So what we're talking about is this week we're going to count down favorite replacements. Songs.
That's right, Jim.
Here on Rock in the Suburbs, I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us all week is...
Phil Ingrassi.
Yes,
get
Phil.
Get that microphone close, Phil.
Got it.
Thank you, Phil, for joining us. Phil, tell us a little bit before we dive into the songs about your Minnesota background and kind of how you came to be in that part of the country and what point you're in your life.
There's a specific reason why we wanted Phil
That's right.
Well, I grew up in the Twin Cities, and, you know, this is my wheelhouse. You know, you look back at the replacements in the early 1980s, and it's like Beatles and Hamburg, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
But, I was there, and I saw them with 20 people, and then I saw them when they were more popular in theaters and stuff. And just a great Minneapolis band, and the music is just full of Minnesota references.
Absolutely.
So you were born and raised in Minneapolis?
I was born in Peoria, Illinois, and then moved as an infant when my dad got transferred to a Minnesota insurance company. But I grew up there.
Okay.
And so you lived there until what year?
I graduated from college in 84, so that's when I left Minnesota.
So your time there overlapped with the replacements earliest years.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And I really know what he's writing about sometimes because I worked downtown Minneapolis when I was in high school. So I get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And did you bring any Grain Belt beer?
No, and I couldn't find any hams either. So
that's right. The hams beer. Phil, did you ever go to the appropriate Monday morning, crack one open.
Beer for breakfast.
That's right. Did you ever go to Warfolk Jokopolis? Am I saying that right? Did I mix up my syllables? The record store?
Yeah, there was a lot of different record stores in Minneapolis. That was one of them, Positively 4th Street, and the Wax Museum.
Ah, okay.
All right, so we have a whole week to look at Phil's story here. We'll pepper that in
I'll
as we go.
Okay.
We got to play some music.
Got to crack the seal.
So just set this up real quick. We have done this a couple times before with other bands. We did the Beatles and we did Led Zeppelin. And this is the third band, The Replacements. And as I mentioned, people really wanted us to do this countdown. We put the question out to a fan group that's on Facebook, that we have on Facebook. And we asked them to list their top 10 favorite replacement songs. And then you, Patrick, put that all together in a spreadsheet and calculated the results, right?
I did, and I got to say I'm much more proud, and I got to give some credit to my wife, Sheila, for helping me with this spreadsheet, but it's great. It is sortable by vote and also by person, so I put everyone's initials in there, and I color-coded the albums and the year, so I feel really good about the way it came out. I screwed the Zeppelin one up about six different ways, but this one is tight.
In case anybody cares about the color coding.
That's right.
Yes. The spreadsheet, you have that here, right?
So I can give you those colors.
Meticulously compiled here. And then what we're going to do, if we got all the top 10s, how many people participated in this?
We had an all-time record here, Jim, of 32 different voters on this panel. So this is really a group of experts.
That's right.
We're starting to get a little economy of scale,
32
or whatever that
voters,
is.
And there were at least 50-some songs that got at least one vote, right?
That is correct. I can give you the exact number. At least 58 songs.
58 songs.
Got a vote.
Got at least one vote. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to hear over the course of this week the top 15. We're going to do three per day.
That's right.
And here we go. Let's kick off the countdown with number 15. We'll be right back. All right, then that's the ledge off of Pleased to Meet Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fitting that we're kicking this off with that song because that's kind of my replacement's origin.
Is it?
Right there.
Okay.
I'm sure I'd heard some of them before that, but where I really got into the band was with this album.
Okay.
And then I became obsessed with them and then went and became obsessed with Tim and Pleased to Meet Me and
right.
sort of working backwards mm-hmm. from there. But I remember when this came out in 87 and just how much it just kind of floored me. I mean, it was just, I thought it was just a tremendous album, Pleased to Meet Me. And this song, The Ledge, although I wouldn't say it's my favorite one on the album, I know that Sire Records had a lot of hopes for this song.
They did.
And you can hear it. It sounds like sort of a radio-friendly single,
mm-hmm.
except for the subject matter
That's
scared
right.
off a lot of airplay,
yep,
right?
It did.
Being it's about somebody who not only is considering suicide, but actually succeeds in
yeah,
the song.
Exactly right?
right.
Yeah.
If you listen to it, I mean, it is definitely one of the cleanest, I guess, AOR-friendly songs that they ever did.
Mm-hmm. And Paul had a friend named John Zika who did commit suicide at one point, and it quite affected Paul. And he has said, and I will, you know, during the week, go back and pull some information from Bob Mayer's excellent book, Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. If you haven't read that and you like the band, you're really missing out. It is the complete story. Paul said he took some of John's personality on his own when John died. And that's a really interesting thing, but this apparently was a very draining song to record as well. But yeah, it was a time when that song might have made it for the Replacements. They were pushing very hard. Sire Records, they were recording in Arden Studio with Jim Dickinson, and you know, as Phil said, the sound they got really was very palatable. Unfortunately, it was paired, you know, with the very, very dark lyrics. I know that's a combination you like, Jim.
Well, yeah, although
this one isn't outwardly poppy as some.
No, that's what I'm talking about when I say that I like sad songs that sound happy isn't exactly what this is. This is a sad song that really is just a sad song.
Really,
I mean,
sad.
Like a really, like not yeah. just sad, like I broke up with my girlfriend sad.
Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously very troubling. But what I think makes it work and why I think people respond to it and why it got voted into this top 15 is that it's so like brutally honest, I think, about these kinds of feelings that somebody this depressed would have.
Yeah.
And that it's called The Ledge, and it's about somebody, you know, obviously out on a ledge about to jump. And yet what he's talking about is he's like, I'm the boy they can't ignore
yeah.
for the first time in my life. I'm sure it's like anyone who's ever just had kind of any depressive thoughts or whatever, your mind tends to go to that. Like, well, if I do, if I do this, like then they'll all be sorry, or then they'll, you
That's
know,
right.
whatever, you know. I think that's a natural sort of place for the mind to go sometimes. And here he's just, you know, he's putting it out there that somebody who gets to that point in their life, like, I think he's very articulate about what they're really feeling there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's not a sappy song about, you know, hold on, you'll make it through or
right.
whatever. No, it's like,
yeah.
it's brutally honest
yeah.
about somebody who's very troubled. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Well,
yes.
So the other thing is we have some listener comments.
Yes.
So some of the people who submitted their top 10s also commented
mm-hmm.
on various songs. I'm going to read some of those as we go through this countdown. We only got one comment on this particular song, and it's from Ben Montgomery. And he says, who knew that the punks could write a socially conscious song?
Yeah,
so
true.
So there's that, too. If you take it from the standpoint of it's sort of a it's a commentary on life and, like I said, sort of, you know, depression and the society that leads people to this, right?
Yeah, and reportedly cut in one take for these sessions. It was like we hit the background music and Westbrook, you know, sang it on the first take and nailed it and basically said, I hope I don't have to do that again because I just left it all in there.
You can hear it. I mean,
yeah.
That's the other thing, too. You can hear the emotion in this song. The other thing, you know, this comes from Pleased to Meet Me, which was the first album without Bob Stinson.
That's right.
Who obviously was very troubled mm-hmm. as well. And so I think there's some dynamic there. The other thing I really like about this song too, just sort of musically, that break where it gets into like harmonics
yeah.
and stuff like that.
Very
like
cool.
that's you don't expect that necessarily from just kind of a blazing guitar band
that's
kind of
right.
band, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well said.
All right. Take a deep breath.
Yeah, that was a tough one to start with.
Yep. Should we move on to number 14?
Yes, let's do it.
Kids Don't Follow.
Kids Don't Follow from Stink.
Yes.
The EP that came out after their debut album. Sorry, Mar, I forgot to take out the trash in 1982.
Yes.
That song, just looking here, is one of three of the seven songs that actually gets over 2 minutes on this record. Everything else is under 2 minutes. So it's a powerful sort of trashy punk, you know, kind of the peak of that real driving sound that they had early on. And obviously, incredible guitar work from Bob Stinson there. He was extremely sharp on this track.
There were a bunch of bands in Minneapolis that were famous for these 1 minute and a half songs, like Suicide Commandos and Urban Gorillas. And this album kind of fit into that niche of, hey, we're going to just blow the doors off here really quickly and get it over with.
Yeah. And obviously the party dialogue at the beginning is pretty priceless and classic.
Is there a better opening to a song?
Probably not. No.
Dave Perner is the voice, apparently, you can hear on there. He was I was actually from a party, right?
Yeah, like replacement show.
That's not something staged in the studio.
No.
Very Minnesotan, too, you know. Could have been in Fargo, that cop, I think. Yeah. You know?
He's actually kind of polite, really. Yeah. So you just get your stuff together and go.
And nobody goes to jail. That's what I'm telling you.
So the backstory on this song is that Paul Westerberg was inspired by U2's I Will Follow, right?
That's right. Yeah. Apparently had seen U2 play a set where they played I Will Follow twice early in their career. They played it sort of at the beginning and again at the encore. And, you know, loved the music of it, the anthemic sort of quality, but really didn't agree with the sentiment of the lyric and wanted to write something, you know, much more from his perspective, like how he saw it.
Right. Yeah. But it's kind of similar. Like the riff is even kind of a play on I Will Follow riff and kind of way when you hear that
kind of riff.
But it's as much as I love I Will Follow, I think it's a great sort of rock song. But this is like he ramped it up, man. Yeah. This is a driving rock song.
Yeah, it really is. And for those of you who may have a copy of Stink, this one you'll know because the covers are all different because they were hand stamped by Peter Jespersen and others because they had just put out the debut not all that long ago, and they didn't really have any money, Twin Tone. And they said, okay, we'll pay for the manufacturing, but we'll get blank jackets, and you'll have to actually stamp them. And Peter Jespersen, their manager and early supporter, said, okay, I'll do it. And there's a couple stories online where the record store would get blank copies, and they would also get the stamp and the ink pad. So when someone wanted to buy it, the employees would actually stamp the record.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I want to show this to Phil, because before I got a copy of Stink, I heard this song on a Twin Tone compilation. Oh. So remember back in the day when you go record shopping, some labels would put out compilations as a way to get you into other bands. And they're usually pretty cheap and you could buy them, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I first heard Kids Don't Follow was on this right here. I'm going to show this to Phil. It's called Twin Tone, More Hits from Mid-America. And look at this album cover.
Yeah.
Nice.
Nice. Armin Killebrew.
There you go.
There you go.
I knew. Yeah, you're a big Twins fan, obviously.
Right. The Twin Tone was really a shoestring operation, but there's a very famous punky compilation called Big Hits Mid-America Volume 3. And so I guess that's kind of a play on that. But that was a huge album. Was a double record, and it had the Pistons and the Hipsters and all these early, early Midwestern punk bands. And worth a show in itself, by the way. That whole album is awesome.
All right. Great. That would be very cool.
The one listener comment we got on this song came from Harris King.
All right, Harris, South Carolina.
Says, this song for me is one of the Matt's first true great songs coming out of their hardcore sound. And to find out recently that it was supposedly written in response to U2's I Will Follow after Paul saw them live makes it even better.
That's great. Yes. Yeah. Now, this one was on your list, Jim. You picked this on your top 10.
It was.
None of us, we'll tell you guys if you care, none of the three of us in this room chose The Ledge on our personal top 10.
No, not to say I don't like the song.
Not
but yes,
at all.
When you're getting down to 10 songs, you got to make some choices. But
you're only allowed 10. I think we all struggled with this assignment.
But Kids Don't Follow to me is one of the top examples of the Replacements just going all out, playing just driving rock and roll, you know, and that's, I'm sure we're going to talk about this throughout the week. There's really two sides to this band. There's the rock side and there's sort of like the sensitive side of the band. Both sides though really have great lyrics and that's, I think, one of the reasons why people respond to this band so much, not just for the sound, but the lyrical content. But to me, this is just like, you know, you just want, it's, you know, I think it's what you want as a rock fan. You just want a band that can just like hit the gas and 2.5 minutes later, yeah, hit the brake. Right.
That's
and
right.
It's like a dragster.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And another example of that on this album, Dope Smoking Moron, you know, it's got one of my favorite breaks in there where they stop and someone says, hey, Merle, you got any lewds on you? And they roar right back into the song after like just that little break.
You know, and the other thing about Stink, you know, it's an EP, although it wasn't it like 8 songs or something?
7.
Like,
pretty close. No, you're right. 8. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. 8 songs.
A lot of albums have 8 songs on them. So yeah. I always thought it was, I guess, because yeah, they're such short songs.
Very short.
And also when you release something as an EP, there's not the same kind of pressure as putting out an LP. I also think Without Kids Don't Follow, I mean, there's some other really good songs. There's F School and there's, you know, some funny, but it's mostly kind of a jokey record.
Yeah, a little bit.
This is, I think, the anchor.
Yes,
of
definitely.
This record, mm-hmm, you know.
And reportedly the motivation for recording it was like, we got to get this one out because it's so good. It yeah, was a breakthrough for Westerberg. And what else you got?
That's
well,
right.
I got these other ones all right or I had, you know, so stuck in the middle. A great example of that, too.
All right. Move on?
Let's move on.
All right. Here's number 13. Totally different from what we just heard.
Yes.
Never finishes, she abandons, never shows a soul. And she's kinda like a movie that everyone rushes to see, and no one understands it. Sitting in their seats, she opens her mouth to speak and but comes out so mystery. Thought about, not understood. She's aching to be. Well, she dances alone in nightclubs every other day of the week. People look right through her. Baby, don't check your cheek.
Aching to Be from Don't Tell a Soul, one of the mm-hmm, later records. And you can hear sort of the maturation of the band, I think, in that song. This is where they were, you know, much older than what we heard in Kids Don't Follow.
That's right.
And, you know, Paul was really writing, I think, from a different perspective. But interestingly, you know, those little country tinges in the guitar work and everything there. And I think a lot of that was because at this point, Slim Dunlop was in the band. But it still goes back to the earliest days. We were talking off mic about how their very first single that they put out
yeah,
before their first album was I'm in Trouble, backed with If Only You Were Lonely. Uh-huh. And If Only You Were Lonely is a Westerberg sort of country song.
Right.
So from the very beginning, he was doing kind of this sensitive material, and with some of that, I think it's kind of a almost kind of like a barroom kind of quality,
yeah,
I think is what drew him to that kind of a sound. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think this is by far the best song on the record. And I remember when Don't Tell a Soul came out, I was very disappointed in it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't like the lead single, I'll Be You, talent show. I come around, I've warmed up to these over the years, but
yeah,
at the time, you know, coming off Please to Meet Me, which
yeah,
was such a great record,
yep,
and then this was kind of a letdown. It had the sheen. It was obviously meant to get MTV play. And at the same time, some of my other favorite bands were putting out really good albums, like U2, Unforgettable Fire, and REM had this string of great records. And this just seemed like a letdown. But this song, I mean, mm-hmm, it's all there. And it really is a foreshadowing of Paul's solo records, I think.
Really well said, Phil. And you know, I think that it's interesting and appropriate for us to say at the first episode of this week that one of the motivations is that Don't Tell a Soul is coming up on its 30th anniversary
yes,
this summer, and there's going to be a box set issued
yes,
shortly. Maybe by the time you hear this, it might be out.
I think it's in September
okay,
that it comes out. But yes, good point. This is a special box set of an alternate version
yep,
of Don't Tell a Soul and some outtakes and so on. And It's like
LPs. Having said I didn't like it, I just pre-ordered it.
Okay.
It's $80, and okay. If you order it, pre-order it, you'll get a cassette with it.
Yeah.
And they've evidently taken a lot of the stuff I didn't like off of it. And there's a talent show is available for streaming right now, and it sounds a lot better to me.
Does it really? Interesting.
To my ears, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So, yeah, so you're right. So this is from that era, and I think a lot of fans, you know, felt like Phil did that, that the band, quote-unquote, sold out with this record, mm-hmm. that they really were listening to, I think, Sire Records, and like, we need you guys now to, like, move some units.
That's right.
Now, this album is their best-selling album. Last time I checked, by like a factor of two, I think it was like.
Oh, was that right?
But it was mostly because of I'll Be You, I think. That was a kind of a big MTV hit single and may have even charted. I don't know. And
I think it charted for a little while. Did anybody even vote for that in our little poll? I wonder. Because
there were votes. It didn't make the top 15.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Because I'm sure that was a lot. You know, I'm old, so I'm sure that was the first time a lot of people even saw.
That's right.
So if that's a gateway drug into the Replacements, that's great.
Yes.
I just don't think it's anywhere close to their best work.
Right. And you know what strikes me really interesting about the band, and it's something you don't really think about, but, you know, we all sort of realize it in the back of our minds. Like, and this song is a really good example. Paul Westerberg's lyrics were so great. They were so clever. It was so well structured. Yet they never put the lyrics on any of their albums. And if there was ever an album that you were going to put the lyrics on, it would have been this one. Like, you know, just Akin to Bee's lyrics just written down are like so clever and so smart. And all his songs, like Phil was saying, contain references to places and people and these little turns of phrase that you'd really love to have written down officially to like study. But no, they would never. He was never going to let that happen.
And again, I think there's a real honesty in this music too.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that's in particular what elevates this song. You get the sense it's not just a guy sitting down trying to write a hit song. It's like this like comes from his soul. Yeah. You know?
It's almost he couldn't not.
Right.
You know, a lot of times like I have to let it out.
And so speaking of lyrics, we got two listener comments on this song in particular, and both of them just started with this line.
Yeah.
If no one's on your canvas, I'm aching to be, right?
You know, there you go.
It's like, that's just such a great line. And then Mike Wagner goes on to say, it's an absolutely perfect lyric and a Westerberg masterpiece. Should also note, Slim plays some really nice guitar on this track. I know many fans prefer Bob to Slim, but I prefer Slim's playing to Bob's. Yeah. Slim was such a great player and so overlooked. I read that Chrissy Dunlop, Slim's wife, was the one that found the tapes for the Don't Tell a Soul reissue. Or, you know, reworking. If you don't belong to Slim's Facebook page, you should. So much love on that page, and Chrissy is the sweetest. So there you go. That's from great. Mike Wagner.
Nice,
good,
Mike.
Good shout out there. You know, there was something about Slim Dunlop.
Rest and in again, power.
Well, he's still around.
Oh, that's right.
But he's not doing too well. He had suffered a stroke a few years
that's
ago.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, Slim.
Sorry. But it's funny. They added him to the band after they fired Bob, almost like sort of in defiance of the label again.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's like, we're going to bring in this guy who'd been around the Minneapolis scene like forever, is older than us and looks it too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And right when you're really trying to push and make us a big band, that's what we're going to do. But he was he was a very well-respected guitarist and played in a lot of different bands in Minneapolis. And he kind of had that kind of old soul nature about him that I think works really well in this song in particular.
Right. And he definitely had that screw you attitude to everybody, right? That endeared him, I think, to the Replacements.
Didn't you have a funny story about him getting hit with something at a
I did, at a
concert?
I saw the first tour, I believe, that Slim was playing with the Replacements, and they were playing in Charlottesville at a place called Trax in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Slim was very slim.
Yes.
And he gets hit in the chest with a full beer that somebody threw, and it knocks him off his feet. He goes backwards into the amplifier. It's just one beer, like, thwap, and he just keels over backwards. It was a good shot. Probably a, you know, UVA pitcher
and
or something.
Did Tommy jump into the crowd and beat somebody up?
No, he didn't, but there was definitely some yelling and screaming.
Tommy would have said, oh, wow, punk rockers.
Yeah, that's right.
Something
or that.
Like that.
Just
make
fun of
it.
Is that
the best you got?
Yeah.
Sure, you can knock over Slim. Try me.
Right.
Slim's got a great solo record if people want to you know, dig around. It's awesome. I love that one.
Totally agree.
Early 90s, I think it came out.
And the Songs for Slim compilation that they put together has some really interesting stuff if you're a Replacements fan. I think when we talked to Tommy, we may have talked about that a little bit. Tommy Stinson.
I think this is a good start to this countdown because you really get like three different kind of tones of really the Replacements, do. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So what will tomorrow bring?
Bum, bum, bum.
You can listen again tomorrow because you're listening
every day.
Every day here on all the big podcast platforms. And you can still weigh in on the Replacements. I'm sure we can follow this up with your thoughts and comments. You can call 612, which is a Minneapolis area code.
That's right.
612-440-1984. Or email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at suburbspod. All right. Phil, you going to stick around?
I will.
Cool, man.
He will follow. All right. Yeah. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
I'm Phil Ingrassia.
We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
This is kind of like an artist who uses paints no more. And never show me what you're doing. Never show a soul. But I saw one of your pictures. There was nothing that I could see. If no one's on your canvas, then I'm aching to be. She closes her mouth to speak and closes her eyes to see. Thought about and only love, she's
put a pub on every corner.